From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. Science and technology that's accessible, interesting, and if we can understand it, so will you. I'm John Wells. I'm here with Lynn Ware Peak. Our first guest is Charles Bacon, who's the Enabling Technology Systems Engineer for NASA's Satellite Servicing Projects Division. The ability to robotically service satellites offers many advantages over current astronaut-involved missions. Many of the technologies being developed for this autonomous ability will also be used in future Mars missions. Charles Bacon will be with us to help us understand these technologies. And Lynn, I'm really looking forward to this conversation.
I know you are. Good morning, John. Our second guest this morning is Mario Livio, who has written a book called Why? What Makes Us Curious? The ability to ask why is uniquely human, and yet there is still no definitive scientific consensus about why that is. The book is a crash course that examines questions like, what are the symptoms of exceptional curiosity? What is the relationship between curiosity and memory? Does curiosity remain stable across our lifespan, or does it change with age? Do YouTube, Twitter, and Wikipedia erode our ability to be amazed?
These two guests plus today's cool story when we return. You're listening to Cool Science Radio. Stay with us. Okay, we're having some challenges with our underwriters, but that's okay. We're going to go right back to Cool Science Radio. Our first guest, Charles Bacon, who's the Enabling Technology Systems Engineer for NASA Satellite Servicing Projects Division. Bacon has served as an expert in the field of satellite servicing for more than 10 years, and since 2009, he's provided mission systems design engineering support for the Satellite Servicing Projects Division at NASA's Goddard Space Flight in Greenbelt, Maryland. In this role, he's made significant engineering contributions to many of the agency's most ambitious servicing projects, including RRM, which is the Robotic Refueling Mission, where he was awarded the Space Flight Awareness Honoree Award by NASA for his work on the RRM servicing demonstrations. Charles Bacon, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Charles, before we talk about satellite servicing technology that can be used on Mars missions, let's talk about servicing satellites around Earth. We all know that the ability to robotically service satellites is going to have advantages over current astronaut-involved missions, but maybe you can take us through what some of those advantages are and what are some of the things that we're testing.
Sure. Well, the currently satellites that go up into orbit that orbit around the Earth, there's no way to repair them. There's no way to fix them, and things do go wrong. And the ability to be able to repair or replenish or refuel those satellites, because one of the things that does go wrong often is the satellites just simply run out of fuel. So being able to do that and take these expensive assets and continue their life would offer a lot of advantages for our operations in space. So that's one of the things that we're working on with this RestoreL mission.
And the tricky thing, of course, is in a low Earth orbit, these satellites are moving at 17,500 miles an hour or approximately that speed. And the servicing, the robotic, the autonomous unit needs to be at that same speed. So it's a little tricky, coming up on it and doing all this without having an astronaut involved, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. So we learned a lot from how to do repair and upgrades in space when we were working on the Hubble Space Telescope servicing missions. But of course, those involved astronauts. And when you have astronauts, there's a lot more you can do, a lot more capability that humans have over robots. So we're able to accomplish some really intricate tasks. And now we're trying to find ways to do things without astronauts and to use robots in space. And we're finding a lot of challenges, and we're overcoming those technical issues. But certainly rendezvousing with the spacecraft that you want to go service is one of the things that we're working with right now. And we're finding challenges from you know, being able to maintain communications and being able to maintain, you know, power to the spacecraft, how the spacecraft's oriented, making sure that the solar arrays are in a position to provide the spacecraft power. Balancing all those things is certainly very tricky.
It's so fascinating to think about, especially in the case of satellites, some of which have been in orbit for quite a while and maybe not having the technology on the satellite itself that's meant to receive the help from a spacecraft. And so I'm wondering, well, first of all, I guess the question would be, how long have some of the satellites been in orbit?
Yeah, I mean, some of them have been in orbit for you know, 10, 15 years or maybe even more. Usually the 15 years is probably the expected lifetime. Obviously, I mentioned the Hubble Space Telescope earlier. Right. That's been in orbit now for more than two decades. So some of them are up there for a very long time. And none of the, well, except for Hubble and ISS, really, none of them were designed to be serviced. So that is something that we're finding as we work on the mission that we're doing now to go service a satellite that wasn't designed for servicing. How do we actually do these things when there was no nothing put into the spacecraft design to accommodate it? So we're working through those challenges. There are a lot of spacecraft in orbit right now like that. And so there's a lot of technologies that we're developing that could continue to service these satellites for the next couple of decades that weren't designed for it. And those satellites are continuing to be built today. But we're also working on finding what ways that we can influence the design of satellites that are in work now before they launch that they could accommodate servicing and make that task even easier.
Charles, can you give us a for example on that in terms of, you know, what is one of the challenges, you know, what can a servicing spacecraft do to adapt a satellite that's been in orbit for 10 or 15 years?
So, yeah, there's a whole level and spectrum. So if you're talking about what we can do to service satellites that haven't been designed to be serviced and that are already up in space, one of the biggest challenges and one of the things that we're focusing on is refueling, because that has the most applicability. All satellites need fuel. So we're finding that what we can do is we have to go in and we have to access the satellite's fuel valve. These things are usually closed out for launch, you know, under the assumption that they'll never be kind of accessed again. And now we want to go in there. We want to cut away thermal blankets. We want to cut away lock wires, remove caps on the valves that were put in place for launch, and actually access the fuel valve to refuel it. So we're working through the steps of how do we do that. We've been working on that for years now, and actually have come up with a lot of really good solutions. And one of the things that we came up with was we figured out a way to attach a kind of a separate valve on top of the existing one to accommodate refueling. So in the process of refueling this satellite, we would attach what we call a quick disconnect, and it goes on the existing valve, and we can actually leave that in place so that if that satellite wanted to be refueled again, the entire process would be a lot easier.
And Charles, you also have a lot of low cost and no additional weight type things that you have sent out to the people that put the satellites up in the air that they can do for future satellites. It's going to make it a lot easier. For example, instead of using tape to seal off insulation in certain areas of the satellite, to use Velcro so that the robotic arm can easily open up the panel, that sort of thing. So there's a lot of things that can be done for the future, isn't there?
Yeah, there are. The Velcro is a really great example. And as you said, it's no additional cost or weight. It's just use this instead. We've also identified some things like we're actually working on coming up with designs, and we have a couple already for what we call friendly fiducials. And these are basically small decals that you put on the outside of the spacecraft that can be used by the machine vision algorithms in the servicing spacecraft. So when you're trying to do a rendezvous, you can actually find the spacecraft easier and line up with it. Makes that process a lot simpler and a lot less risky. And that's just a small sticker, really, that goes on the outside of the spacecraft. And then the other big thing that we're developing is the cooperative service valve. So I was talking a minute before about the refueling process and how that can be kind of tricky with the existing design for valves and blanketing. And what we're working on is a valve that can actually replace the standard fuel valves that are put on satellites today that are already designed to accommodate a refueling tool. And they are the same size and mass as the existing valves. So replacing them with this new design is really no impact to the satellite.
Right. And when you put together something like a Mars mission over a tremendous distance, and you want to reduce weight as much as you can, and I was fascinated to read that you have some products out there that will allow methane to be refueled in space. Well, actually, to start with, to take CO2, convert it to methane, and then to be able to refuel the spacecraft in space versus carrying around all this heavy propellant.
Right. So one of the projects that we have in development right now back at Goddard is the Robotic Refueling Mission 3. And this is going to be a payload that launches up to the space station next year that will actually do some demonstrations for cryogen management and refueling in space. So being able to do a couple of things, store the cryogen long-term in zero-G has some challenges because of the boil-off associated with cryogens. So being able to store it and then being able to transfer it, being able to move it from one tank to another, again, because of some of the tricky issues and properties associated with cryogens, this is a lot easier, or this is a lot harder than it is when we're talking about, the fuel for the satellites that are generally, fluids that are at room temperature. The cryogen properties make this all a lot trickier. So being able to transfer those cryogens without, having a lot of boil off or without getting any air bubbles is one of the things that the RM3 mission on ISS, we're looking to demonstrate that. So when you talk about going to Mars and understanding that you're going to have the ability to transfer these cryogens that are going to be needed, being able to store them long-term and transfer them is going to be really useful technology.
Avery, just joining us, our guest is Charles Bacon. He's the Enabling Technology Systems Engineer for NASA's Satellite Servicing Projects Division. And this is just fascinating. I think on a really simple level, when we have for example, a vehicle, an automobile that's powered by diesel, and then we decide that we want to start introducing biodiesel into it, or if we want to convert it from gas to be able to be fueled by French fry oil, we think that's pretty complicated. And it's just fascinating to me that you're doing this in the darkness of space, at 17,000 miles an hour. Does it ever... Do you ever find it staggering yourself, just that you can't believe the work that you're doing?
Absolutely, yeah. When you take a step back from it and you think about kind of what we're talking about doing and the ambitious nature of it, you kind of realize how big of a deal it is. For decades now, that we've kind of been living under this paradigm of satellites launch into space and you never see them again. And we're changing that with this technology that we're developing and with these mission, demonstration missions that we're doing. So it's a big deal. And when you think about how that technology can be transferred over to, missions going out beyond Earth's orbit, That's pretty impressive.
Absolutely. So a technology module called Raven was launched aboard a SpaceX 10 mission to the International Space Station. I believe it was earlier this year in February. Is that right?
Yeah, you know, I think that is right, or maybe it might have been late last year. I honestly can't remember.
All right. And how closely were you involved in that mission?
So I was not involved in that one. I was working on the robotic refueling mission. So some of my development work was going on in parallel with the Raven mission. So there was another team we had set up to work on that one. So I was kind of seeing that one in development from the outside.
So the autopilot capabilities of Raven sort of mirror the same technology that you're working on. Is that right?
Yeah, right. So what we're doing with Raven is using it as a test bed for a lot of the autonomous rendezvous technologies that we need. So there, not only the sensors, but also the software that's required to run on the Restore L mission, which is the project that I'm currently working on. So in order to Restore L is a mission that we're going to go refuel Landsat 7, which is a previous NASA mission that launched a while ago without any need for service or without, you know, having servicing in mind. And so to be able to do that, we have to be able to launch our own servicing spacecraft and rendezvous with it. And the sensors and software required to do that that's hard to test on the ground. This is one of those things where you really need to. Do on orbit tests and demonstrations to be able to get accurate data, and that's what Raven's doing for us. Is we can use the on-orbit environment of space station and have it analyze the visiting vehicles that are coming up to space station to test out those sensors and algorithms. So, and then we can take that data and apply it to the Restore L mission.
Extending the shelf life of these satellites is a way to save tremendous amounts of money for the people that are putting these up, especially in the commercial side. Is this something that we can make money on? Is this something that NASA can build a business around?
Well, NASA's not looking to build a business around this. What we're looking to do is develop the technology so that we can provide it to a number of different groups. You know, obviously we want to have it, the ability for NASA to have this technology and to have this capability is worth something to NASA for sure, so that it could service its own assets. In addition, we're working very hard to be able to make sure that other groups can have access to the same technology. Earlier this year, we had a industry day where we invited people from the commercial industry to come in and look at some of the technology that we're developing and start talking about ways that they could actually license it for their own purposes. And in parallel with that, we're working with other government agencies to make sure that they can have access to the same technology. So it's not necessarily something that we're looking to make a business out of, but we're certainly hoping that that other people can.
How careful do we have to be with the technology as far as sharing it? I just have to believe, as I look at all the different pieces that you're currently investigating right now, that there are military applications for these pieces as well. What do we do to safeguard our intelligence?
Yeah, so we have a lot of safeguards in place. The technology that we're developing cannot be shared with international partners or other international groups. So, for example, I mentioned we had an industry day recently, and that was something that was invitees could only be U.S.-based companies. So we do recognize that as an issue, and we have a lot of safeguards in place to manage the information to ensure that only the people who we want to get it are getting it.
That's pretty interesting. So I want to ask you a little bit about the relationship, not in this case with international partners, but with these private enterprises like SpaceX, for example. And I've never asked anyone who works for NASA how that relationship works between a private enterprise that's very nimble, between government agency that can be very slow and cumbersome yet well-funded. What are your thoughts on that?
What we're doing with our technology is we are trying to, develop it to a point where a commercial company could actually, set up a license agreement with NASA to be able to use it. And there are some, steps there where they have to demonstrate a need for it. And we have to work to transfer them the proper data. But I think it works out well because by, us kind of doing some of the initial engineering that's required to develop these technologies and having somebody who can, utilize them via, technology license, mm-hmm. That saves the commercial company from having to invest their own funds, or a lot of their own funds, but then they can go and make a business with it. So I think it's a good relationship.
Absolutely. Well, SpaceX, for example, has achieved celebrity status. Perhaps it's the whole Elon Musk connection there, and we hear about what SpaceX is doing quite often in the news. Who are some of the other players that you work with in terms of private enterprise?
Right. So SpaceX does launch services for NASA. So after the retirement of the space shuttle, NASA started contracting with private companies to be able to launch resupply missions to the space station and to be able to launch satellites. Those contracts that NASA has set up. They also have other contracts with other companies. Another one, who I believe is also currently on contract to resupply the International Space Station, is Orbital ATK. And so they have their own launch vehicle and their own vessel for going up to the space station. And there's a couple of other, the United Launch Alliance, ULA, is another company that the government contracts with to do launches. So those are all out there. And then there's other ones that are coming into play as well. And so when you start talking about some of the future missions that might be required to go beyond, low Earth orbit or Earth orbit, I think there are other companies who are starting to develop technologies internally that they would hope would be something that they could contract with the government to provide services for later.
Right. I have to say I'm a little ashamed of myself for not initially listing Orbital ATK, part of which is located
right here in
Utah. And John's been out to some of the testing out there. It's in the West Desert of Utah.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, we have spoken about converting Mars atmosphere gases, CO2, into methane, and then the ability to refuel methane in the spacecraft out around the Mars orbit. You also mentioned, or it's in one of the sheets here, solar electric propulsion utilizing xenon. I don't even know what xenon is, but can you tell us...
Xenon,
okay.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us what solar electric propulsion is and how we would utilize it?
Sure. Yeah, it's a different kind of propulsion. So when we talk about, mostly when we're talking about refueling satellites that use thrusters, that use liquid propulsion to create thrust. The solar electric propulsion uses xenon as a gas, and it's solar electric because it requires a lot of power to heat the xenon gas and use that to create thrust. So The advantages over liquid propellant, though, systems is that the xenon is, since it's a gas, it's a lot lighter. So you can have, and you also get, it's a more efficient system. But I think the downside is that it doesn't create as much thrust. So you can use it to go really far distances, and that's its main advantage. And that's why we're interested in talking about it for going to Mars. So by utilizing those, utilizing a solar electric propulsion system, because as opposed to a liquid propulsion system that would that would be very large and heavy trying to use that to get to Mars. So storing xenon and using the electric propulsion to get to Mars creates a smaller, lighter system. Another thing that we're developing for the robotic refueling mission 3 that I talked about before for the cryogen demonstration, it has another part where it's doing a xenon transfer demonstration. So in the same way that we talk about, if we're going to have these vehicles or habitats that are going out to Mars that are going to require cryogens, we have these same vehicles that are going to require xenon as its fuel. And we want to be able to replenish those systems as well to be able to reuse those vehicles. Yeah. So on RM3, we are doing a demonstration to show that we can actually do a transfer of the xenon gas in space.
Charles, several months ago, we had a conversation with Benjamin Reed, Deputy Project Manager for the Satellite Servicing Projects Division, and he was talking a little bit about asteroid acquisition and redirection. Is that something that you are working on?
That's not something I'm currently working on. There was a asteroid mission that NASA had been working on up until earlier this year, but recently that's been project's been canceled, and that work has kind of slowed down. There's still some of the technologies that were being developed for that mission are still in development, but the overall mission is no longer moving forward.
Charles Bacon, Enabling Technology Systems Engineer for NASA Satellite Servicing Projects Division. And Lynn, he's also a TERP. He's a graduate from University of Maryland in College Park. That's my alma mater, by the way.
All right. Yeah.
Yeah. And I have to believe that there's a decent percentage of TERPs working in Greenbelt since it's right next door.
That's correct. Yeah. Yeah. We have a lot of them over there, and it's really great when you get to work with some of the people that you went to college with,
right.
And to have that connection. Yeah.
Charles, thanks so much for joining us. We'd love to have you back sometime.
Okay. Yeah.
Thanks, Charles.
You.
When we return, we'll have a conversation with Mario Livio, who has written Why? What Makes Us Curious? You're listening to Cool Science Radio. Stay with us.
Miller Orthodontics is a proud supporter of The Randy Barton Show. Since 1988, my wife and I have provided a combined 45 years of orthodontic care. For our Invisalign patients, we provide digital scanning and imaging technology that eliminates the need for wet molds of your teeth. More information is at m2ortho.com.
This is Steve Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties. We continue to be proud supporters of KPCW, our local source for Park City News. Our agents are Summit and Wasatch County's source for real estate, and we can be reached at bhhsutah.com.
Beth here, owner of Peak Art and Frame, longtime supporters of KPCW. At Peak Art and Frame, we carry a wide variety of framing options, and our design staff can help with any project for your home, office, or gallery. Open Monday through Saturday and located in the Walmart Shopping Center, 649-0801 or peakartandframe.com.
Earl Foote here with Nexus IT, happy to keep KPCW Radio and their staff running smoothly. We provide sales and maintenance on all computer systems and can guide our customers about cloud solutions for their businesses or personal computer needs. More info available at 435-487-9099 or nexusitc.net.
Well, Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peake, here with John Wells. Quite possibly one of the most interesting things I just learned in that interview is what a terp is.
Terrapin.
I knew your alma mater was University of
Maryland,
but I did not know the mascot was a turtle.
Yeah.
How about that?
Testudo.
Testudo. That's great. Well, really interesting conversation with Charles Bacon. Again, the enabling technology systems engineer for NASA's Satellite Servicing Projects Division. Our guest this half is Mario Livio, who has written a book called Why? What Makes Us Curious? Livio is an astrophysicist. He approaches curiosity from a scientific perspective. He delves into psychology, neuroscience, and evolutionary biology in this brisk narrative exploration of the subject. He interviewed extraordinarily curious people at the top of their fields who weigh in on what drove them to explore various disciplines, and he weaves the latest scientific findings with fascinating stories of the heavyweights of curiosity, like Leonardo da Vinci, Richard Feynman. Mario Livio, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's great to have you back. I think we spoke to you when you wrote Brilliant Blunders, and must that have been about 3 years ago?
About 4 years ago.
Wow, time flies. So Albert Einstein said, I have no special talents. I am only passionately curious. Of course, most of us would disagree with the fact that Einstein had no special talents, but really, this is the basis for your book. It all starts with curiosity.
That's right. Curiosity drives almost everything we do. I mean, from the simplest conversation, you don't want to have a conversation with somebody if you're not somewhat curious about what they have to say. Reading a book, seeing a film, of course, all basic science, when you get deep into the arts, all of these things, education, are driven by curiosity.
Yeah, and do you think that, we always think that children are so curious, and children are asking always the question that is the title of your book, why? And, then somewhere along the line, it gets bred out of us, perhaps. And do you think it's because as we get older, we feel like we need to be experts on something before we can ask questions about it, or before we can even have the license to be curious about it?
I think it's a bit more complex than that. It's true that children ask all the time why, because children very early on understand that every effect has some sort of cause that is linked to it, and they really want to know this cause and effect, because that helps them, in not to make errors in predicting things that are going to happen. What research finds is that this type of curiosity, maybe perceptual curiosity, things like being puzzled by things, being surprised by things, that does tend to decline somewhat with age. But what has been called epistemic curiosity, that's our love of knowledge, really wanting to understand things, that actually stays fairly constant with age.
Fascinating, yeah. I learned so much about Leonardo da Vinci in your book, and there were two things that I just thought was, very interesting. One was that the same person who was capable of so beautifully capturing all these subtle human moods and emotions on paint, he revealed almost nothing of his personal feelings in all of his writings. And I found that fascinating. I mean, we have 6,500 pages of his notes. They think there's another 8,000 or 9,000 pages somewhere, but there was nothing about his personal feelings.
That's true, yes. He was very peculiar that way. He only in very, very rare occasions he said something about how he feels, or that he feels fear, or that in all other places he just is this sort of old observer of nature. While in the paintings, of course, he looks almost emotional in many of them.
Of course. And the other thing that I found fascinating was that in all of his pages with these painstaking drawings and all of these very, very technical notes describing his ideas, interests, contemplations, It was often written with his left hand, written from right to left, and in mirror image. Now, I'm left-handed, so I understand about smudging ink, and I understand the utility of going right to left, and it's not that hard. But he did it in this mirror code. Do you think it was because he didn't want to smudge the ink, or do you think he was trying to keep this information from the church?
Yeah, so various theories have been made about this, but I will tell you that, you know, the real Leonardo experts, in particular Paolo Galuzzi, convinced me that it really had more to do with the technical thing of not wanting to smudge the ink. Because at the end of the day, it's true that it's in mirror image, but that doesn't hide very much, because all you need to do is put a mirror to it and you're able to read it. So, you know, it's not like it's some very secret code that nobody will be able to understand.
That's so funny. What was it about Leonardo that that fascinated you the most?
Well, what fascinated me the most was the fact that here is a gentleman who was literally curious about everything.
Everything.
Mm. I mean, you know, we're all curious about some things, and some of us more things than others. But there is almost nothing he wasn't curious about, with one exception, perhaps, which was politics. If he was curious about politics, he never wrote anything about this, and this was very smart on his part, because he lived at the time of the Borgias, and anyone who got interested in their politics basically got killed. So Leonardo stayed out of trouble by not being curious about politics, but in almost everything else he was curious. He had 106 books at one point in his library, and they cover all the subjects that were known at the time.
That's great. So bringing us into modern day, I wanted to make sure I got a chance to ask you about someone who I think is pretty interesting, and that is, I loved the group Queen growing
yes.
up. Oh, I still love them. And I loved Freddie Mercury, the vocalist, and he was so brilliant, such a genius. But there's Brian May, the guitarist, who is also an astrophysicist.
That's right. Yeah, and I interviewed him because he's such a fascinating personality. He originally did his undergraduate studies in physics and astronomy. Then, of course, he became a famous guitarist, was the lead guitarist of Queen, virtuoso guitarist. And 33 years later, he went back and completed his PhD in astrophysics. In addition to that, you know, he was chancellor of a university. He is a great activist for animal rights. He's an expert in Victorian stereophotography. So, you know, he's a, well, maybe not quite Leonardo, but some sort of a modern Leonardo.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, this is one of the things that I noticed among some of the people that you profile, is that while they have an extreme scientific bent and incredible background in science, they also have this artistic expression.
That's right. For example, you know, I interviewed Fabiola Gianotti, who is, you know, the head of the Center for Nuclear Research in Europe. That's, you know, the Large Hadron Collider, where they discovered the Higgs. She actually led one of the two teams that discovered the Higgs, the particle, you know, which has been dubbed the God particle.
Yes.
But before she was, you know, this incredible physicist, she actually had a degree in music, and she's an accomplished pianist and plays to this very day.
I read a story a couple years ago that Einstein, when he was 10 years old, he used to imagine a photon of light traveling in a locomotive, in a train. You know, they didn't have planes or jets back then, so, you know, the locomotive was the fastest thing. And I'm curious, does imagination fuel curiosity, or is it the other way around?
Well, I think it works both ways, right? I mean, you can imagine some things and then become curious about them. And at the other hand, if you are curious about something, you may imagine what this might be like. For example, you know, you may be curious about, is there life on planets outside the solar system, right? And you may try to imagine what such life may be. And in particular, if you start knowing all the conditions on such a planet, then, you know, you can start imagining, well, it should have those properties, that, in order to survive, and things of that nature. So it really works in both directions.
Right. And I just want to ask a final question about Leonardo, and we'll get on into the neuroscience and those sorts of things. But he wasn't really very good at mathematics. I mean, there are a number of things that Leonardo is given credit for, but mathematics, for an example, he wasn't very good at that. He also couldn't read Greek, and critics have said that actually held Leonardo back.
It's true. He was rather weak in mathematics. I mean, he appreciated mathematics a lot, and even at one point dared to write that nobody who doesn't know mathematics should read his writings. But that was, I think, more wishful thinking than anything else, because he was really quite weak in mathematics. Although, I will say that in curvilinear geometry, you know, in drawing all kinds of complex curves and things, that, because he was so visually inspired, that he was very good at. But you know, really essential mathematics, he didn't know that well.
And you included a picture from his notes of those geometric expressions. So they were pretty complex.
That's right. And not only that, he used those he used to see those in natural phenomena. So, you see, he would look at something, let's say, you know, the waves that propagate from a pebble you threw into a pond. That would immediately translate in his mind into some sort of geometrical curve. And then he would think, where else do I see such curves? And, you know, he would go and draw clouds, and he would go and draw hair of people, and he would go and draw other things that have similar curves. So his mind really wandered through all these, you know, curiosity topics.
Wow. Well, moving on a little bit into, you know, your background, of course, is in astrophysics, and you have now ventured into the fields of psychology and neuroscience. And to what degree did it really help you explain curiosity?
Well, I didn't really know that much about curiosity before starting doing the research. I only knew that I was a very curious person myself, and that's what drove me into this topic. But then, of course, I had to spend literal years. You know, I spent almost 5 years in which I, you know, read all the research in psychology and neuroscience, met with psychologists and neuroscientists, interviewed a number of them, visited labs, and all that, because indeed I wasn't an expert at all in this.
Ah, so John had asked a few moments ago about the bridge between imagination and curiosity, and then I'm wondering about the bridge between curiosity and steps towards action. I mean, you know, is it confidence? Is it, you know, what is it about curiosity that wakes us up and enables us to make that next step?
So curiosity, of course, is intimately linked to exploration. So that is the thing that, you know, makes you do things. Namely, you become very, very curious about something, and that, you know, sort of stimulates you to explore that more. And that exploration could manifest itself in, you know, just delving into very deep scientific research about a certain topic, or getting interest in some artistic aspects of things, or actually, you know, going to places, you know, like going to explore the North Pole or things of that nature. So all of those are driven by curiosity.
If you're just joining us, we're having a conversation with Mario Livio, who has written Why? What Makes Us Curious? Well, the latest technology, fMRI, of course, is one of those technologies. Tell us how you utilized fMRI to reach some of your conclusions and some of the conclusions you were able to reach.
Right. Well, it wasn't I who used it. I mean, other researchers, neuroscientists used it. I just basically, you know, reviewed their research. So, you know, what they do is they take people and they try to make them curious in various ways. For example, by asking them trivia questions, or by showing them blurred images of common objects for them, you know, to puzzle about what the objects are. And they put these people inside MRI machines. And what they do is that while the people are curious, they look at which parts of their brains are activated. And that's how they find, you know, which mechanisms probably play into this act of being curious.
And what are some of the conclusions that came from that?
So there are two in particular that I find really fascinating, which is that there is one type of curiosity which has been dubbed perceptual curiosity, which is the curiosity we feel when there is something that surprises us or puzzles us, or it's, you know, it's ambiguous. And that seems to be associated with parts of our brain that are associated with conflict or, you know, with hunger. It's a particular state that is not very pleasant, and the curiosity then acts to reduce the unpleasantness of the situation, and those parts are activated. On the other hand, there is a curiosity that has been dubbed epistemic curiosity, which is our true love of knowledge, you know, what drives scientific research and so on. And that seems to be activating a part of our brain that is related to anticipation of reward, like, you know, when you are given a piece of chocolate or when you wait to the curtain to go up on a play and things like this. So it does appear that these two types of curiosity are really associated both with different psychological states, and they activate different parts of our brain.
And if Lynn and I were walking through the woods and a grizzly bear jumped out, we would probably be a little curious, you know, what, you know, what's this all about? But at the same time, we'd be frightened. Are you saying that over time we have developed curiosity as a coping mechanism to help alleviate some of the fear? Is that, or am I taking too big a stretch there?
No, I think curiosity does alleviate fear. In fact, you know, I coined this phrase, curiosity is the best remedy for fear, but maybe not quite in the situation with a grizzly. I mean, with a grizzly, you better run away immediately and make very loud noises and, you know, move your hands and so on. But very often what we are afraid of are things that we don't know much about or we don't understand. And if we become curious about them and learn more about them, then we fear them much less. This is why I said curiosity is the best remedy for fear.
I like that. And in a psychological sense as well, and I'm thinking of the fact that hosting this radio program has made both John and I incredibly curious, so much so that when we find ourselves in new settings with a new group of people, for example, it's so much easier to be there now because we're equipped with that curiosity that I think when you put yourself in a new setting, you don't fear as much if you can bring your curiosity to the surface and sort of find out what's surrounding you, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, absolutely, actually. This is exactly what I'm talking about. When you're not that afraid with things that are more familiar to you, and, you know, the way that over, you know, for example, in the Middle Ages, people were kept in fear by oppressive regimes and so on, is by really building walls around certain knowledge. You know, they just like to keep people ignorant of things, and that allowed, you know, the rulers or whomever it was to keep people in fear. But once they become familiar with things, they're much less afraid of those situations.
Wow. This is all sort of bridging the gap here into how we approach politics and why the pundits are so effective in building those walls around knowledge and kind of squelching curiosity, and why they can exist today to to create fear.
Yeah, I think that's one of the most dangerous situations. I mean, you know, this is what led, you know, to the Middle Ages being, you know, the dark ages that they were. This is what led, you know, to book burning at certain periods of time in history. This is what led to, you know, the Nazis doing an exhibit of degenerate art, what they called, where, you know, they amassed all the works of art of the greatest modern artists and labeled them as degenerate, in order, you know, for people not to be interested in those. And this is what leads people like, you know, like ISIS to destroy works of art in Palmyra. So these are very, very dangerous trends that we all, and, you know, I commend you for having this particular program because it acts exactly in this direction of reducing that fear and engaging people in curiosity.
And you have a number of vignettes on various people that are very curious and very accomplished that we may have not heard of before. And there at the end of the book, one of those people is Freeman Dyson, who lays out a beautiful challenge to all of us in The Scientist as a Rebel. I just want to read the quotation because this ties into what we're talking about. "We should try to introduce our children to science today as a rebellion against poverty and ugliness and militarism and economic injustice." That's quite a challenge. I like it.
I would say yes, yes. But, you know, Freeman Dyson is in his 90s now and still extremely active. And, you know, he worked in almost every area of physics and mathematics. He also, you know, writes very often in the New York Review of Books. So he is really an incredible mind, and we should all really take this advice very seriously.
And somebody said in your write-up in that vignette that he believes it's important not to be orthodox and also to be subversive. And he's been subversive all of his life, and not really subversive in the way of a, well, I guess sort of a rebel, but in just his open-minded teachings of what we should be doing and what our priorities should be.
Exactly. And I also quote author Vladimir Nabokov, who said that curiosity is the purest form of insubordination. And I like that very much.
We've got to let you go, Mario, but before we do, I just have to ask you a little bit about Noam Chomsky. I've always been really interested in linguistics, and every time I read something from Chomsky, I was always so amazed at how far out there he would get in seeming other realms of knowledge, and the way he relates words to much bigger concepts.
Yeah, he's, of course, an extraordinary person. I mean, you know, he's, of course, very well known as a linguist, but he's interested in the brain, in music. He, of course, has been active politically. So he's really, again, one of those polymaths of today who knows so many things. Now, it doesn't matter if, I mean, you know, many other linguists don't agree with his ideas that he thought that language appeared, you know, suddenly and not through a long evolution. But it doesn't matter if you agree or disagree with him. His ideas are always interesting.
Absolutely. Well, your ideas are so interesting, Mario. I'm so glad that we could speak with you today. It's been a pleasure. The book is called Why? What Makes Us Curious? Our guest is Mario Livio. Thanks so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you.
I love that stuff.
Yeah, it's a good book.
It really is. And I wanted to ask him, but then we would have gone over in time here. But, you know, he obviously is such a curious person to even get to this point, right, of exploring the topic and how his own curiosity has changed, or has it just been an affirmation for him of, yeah, he's going in the right direction.
One of the things that he said in relation to epistemic curiosity, which is the thirst for just general knowledge, is that it's level set throughout your adult years. So the amount of curiosity you have at the age 25 will be the same at 65, according to the research that he's done.
Interesting. Stay with us. We'll be back after these words from our underwriters.
Spend the day and cover billions of years at the Natural History Museum of Utah. The museum offers innovative exhibits and hands-on experiences. Native voices explore the traditions of Utah's native peoples. The Great Salt Lake Gallery tells the story of the largest saltwater lake in the Western Hemisphere. The Past Worlds exhibit includes more than a dozen new species of dinosaurs discovered right here in Utah. Visit nhmu.utah.edu. The Natural History Museum of Utah is a nonprofit organization and a KPCW supporter.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air, Cruise, and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com. Long, Reimer, Weiniger, Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Hi, this is Beth Lohman from Park City Mountain and proud supporter of KPCW. the Epic School Kids program gives all children across the state of Utah from kindergarten through fifth grade 5 days of skiing plus 1 day rental and lesson. More information at parkcitymountain.com.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peake, here with John Wells. You've been listening to KPCW Park City. I want to thank our underwriters of this show, San Francisco Design, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, Peak Art and Frame, Nexus IT, the Natural History Museum of Utah, and Park City Mountain. Time